Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Todorovich, joined by my co-host, Dr. Matthew Barton. Matty, how are you?
I had a stressful week.
You did have a stressful week. It was, I was stressed
10 days. 10 days.
Yeah. What happened?
Well, I decided to volunteer myself in a clinical trial.
Right.
Okay. Because I saw the advertising. So this is a bit ironic. In a way.
Wait, as the intervention or the control?
The control.
Oh, okay.
The healthy control, Michael, obviously.
Quote unquote, healthy control.
So this particular study at our university was looking, well, not only our university, was looking at, should we introduce today's topic? Or just,
no.
Okay.
Everyone's read it on the.
Okay, all right.
They saw it before they pressed on it.
So this particular study was looking at comparing two groups, long COVID.
Right.
And chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yep.
And they were looking at blood markers as well as MRI scans.
Okay. And so these are people who have self-identified as having long COVID.
Yes. Yes.
And you, having had COVID but not having long COVID, were the control group.
Correct.
You were the had COVID but no long COVID control group. Okay.
So I did the bloods and that seemed to be fine. I got the results back from that. It was all in the normal range.
Okay.
And then I went
that
to.
That was surprising.
Yeah. Then I went to UQ, University of Queensland, to do the MRI scans.
And that, MRI. So what are they looking at?
So that involved two scans, a 3 Tesla and a 6 Tesla.
Right.
So the 3 Tesla was fairly straightforward.
That's referring to strength of the magnet, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That was fairly straightforward. And that was pretty much just stay still in there and relax.
And scan your brain.
Scan your brain.
Not a functional MRI?
That was a 6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so when I went to the 6 Tesla, you actually get dizzy when you go in there. I think the magnets are so strong. You actually feel vertigo.
It feels like, oh, you're spinning.
A little bit.
Okay.
But then you settle. And then in that particular scan, they get you to do a few activities.
Like so what? Maths?
No.
Playing the trumpet?
So in there is a screen. In the first one, I was just watching Monsters, Inc., I think.
It's good.
And then the second one, it had questions pop up and the questions were like, match the word with the color.
Okay.
You know how you have those questions?
Like it said green, red, but it was the color red.
Yeah. You have to press left when it's matched.
I'm right terrible at that.
Yeah. So anyway, I did that. It was fine. And then didn't think anything more of it. But then I got called up by the primary investigator.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, just letting you know that there was a artifact found on your scan. They said they use the term artifact.
On your MRI.
Yeah.
Of your brain.
Correct.
Oh, Jesus.
And then they said our recommendation would be we'll send this to your GP and our recommendation would be to get another scan.
Yeah.
because this was not a clinical based, it was a research based scan.
So they can't ethically tell you what it was or what they saw because it wasn't for that purpose.
Yeah. So I wasn't sure if I had, you know, a tumor or like an aneurysm or a demyelinating lesion or something.
Yeah. When you told me, I was freaking out on your behalf a little bit. I think I was probably more stressed than you were, to be honest.
And you know what? Like that, I'm not exaggerating. That like afternoon,
yeah,
I got a headache.
Yeah, of course.
Because I'm like,
I would have got a headache just from the stress.
Because I'm like, could be a tumor.
Yeah, of course.
And you know, then you think too much into it.
Of course. It's so impossible not to.
So then I went to the GP. The GP was funny. He was good, but he was funny because he's like, what does an artifact mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And he could see the MRI. Did they send that?
They sent a couple, but it was pretty
low res.
Yeah.
Right.
And he couldn't really. But then he asked me a whole lot of questions, which I think is standard with potentially a
like a neurological
occupational lesion. And then it freaks me out more.
Yeah, of course.
And then he does like a full neurological assessment.
And did he realize this guy can't walk or talk properly? Or did he give you any big words to pronounce? Because he would have thought that there's something wrong straight away.
So anyway, he then ordered a clinical MRI.
Right.
Which then I got.
Yeah.
And so for the next couple of days, I was freaking out waiting for the results.
Understandable.
And they're right in front of you.
Oh, okay. Oh, so I can read these out?
You can read it out.
All right. So this is the radiology report.
So first of all,
can I say your date of age and your address?
Medicare
number two.
What the radiologist addressed me as. So.
Mr. Brain. Mr. Brain. Okay. No, I think it's actually MR Brain. So an MRI of the brain.
I think it's Mr. Brain.
It says MRI done on inferior equipment elsewhere has shown an unexplained artifact. So that was what the GP had put through to the radiologist or radiographer. The findings, no evidence of brain. Oh, no evidence of it, of brain.
Empty vault.
This makes sense now.
Yeah.
So it's just all cerebral spinal fluid. That's why when you turn quickly, I just hear a sloshing sound. All right, no, it says no evidence of an acute ischemic episode or infarct. That's good. So you didn't have a stroke
or CDA. Bleed.
All right. No white matter pathology evident on the flare sequence. So that's good for, I assume, like a MS.
Yeah, or a demyelinating condition.
There is normal grey white matter differentiation. That's good. Ventricles are within normal limits. That's what they say when somebody gives birth to a large baby. And they say, well, it's within normal limits. So you've got big ventricles. That's how I interpret that.
Thank you.
But within normal limits. There is increased CSF space, so cerebral spinal fluid space, in the middle cranial fossa around the temporal lobe, likely due to presence of a small arachnoid cyst. No susceptibility artifact evident on the swan. What's the swan?
Don't know. I should
probably look that up. Conclusion. Incidental left arachnoid cyst, otherwise normal study. Thank you for referring this patient. So you've got an arachnoid cyst. So arachnoid being one of the three layers of the meninges, the middle layer, which has the blood vessels and a lot of the vascular supply. So what does it mean? It doesn't say how big it is.
No. And so, I did get the scans now, but it doesn't really mean much to me.
No. Well, I mean, it's only your brain, so what would it?
Unless there's an arrow or circle around a structure. I mean, obviously.
Have you ever had a look yet?
I have.
Could you see anything?
Bruce, like, no.
Oh, no. Interesting.
Because I don't know potentially I know what the structure is, but I don't know if
what the anomaly looks like.
That's right. If that's, you know, it looks like a blood vessel, is that, should it look like that? Or is that
that's why there's people trained up in these particular areas. Mm. Right. So, all right.
So I'm here to live another day.
Congratulations on your cyst and not your tumour. So that's good.
The irony was I thought, I'll do this as a control to rule anything stuff out.
Well, it did. Well, it did rule some stuff out.
A long way around.
But at least you've probably had that forever, right?
Mm.
So, I'm glad that you're here and I'm glad that there's nothing substantially wrong. I mean, subjectively, there's a lot wrong, but at least not anatomically with the brain, but definitely a lot when it comes to cognition.
So that was my week and a half.
Yeah, that's stressful. Mm. That's very stressful. Well, my week and a half was good. I got a new car and I love it, and it's been really nice.
Was it a three or a six?
It's a Tesla. I did buy a Tesla, so which means we've now probably lost half of our audience. I got the Tesla simply because I wanted to get an EV, an electric vehicle.
Save the world.
The government has a lot of tax breaks for the EVs, so that's good. So you can get an EV for cheap. The Tesla
is fast.
That's true, but it happens to have the best tech for the lowest price. And it's a nice looking car and it drives beautifully.
It's kind of like, I was in it with the other day and it's like a combination of like an iPhone.
Yeah, and a spaceship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like flying with Virgin Atlantic.
Yeah, it is, because you've got LED lights that you can change colour.
But driven by an iPhone.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I honestly really like it.
I'm actually surprised how much reliance there is
on tech,
on the console.
Yes, the whole thing is on a screen.
Like even like moving into drive and reverse is.
But in all honesty, because, you know.
I guess you get used to it.
Well, my old man said to me, he's like, oh, what happens if it, you know, craps itself? And I go, well, the same thing happens if my other car craps itself. I don't know how to fix that. I don't know how to fix this. True. So I still need a professional to come and fix it. But I like it. I do like it. My kids love it. There's a little screen in the back that they can watch YouTube and Netflix. So that's pretty cool. I wouldn't call it a car. I would call it software on wheels.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally. There's no soul in the car. Like there's no feel.
Did your last car have a soul?
What was my last car? I had that old Mazda 3 that I'm trying to get rid of at the moment. No one's taking off me. But that's okay. I won't advertise that here because I can't get a roadworthy for it. All right, so let's jump into our episode.
Today, what are we talking about?
We are talking about the fed state, also known as the postprandial state or postprandial metabolism.
Also known as the
post-absorptive state.
Before you get much further, this...
Or is it the... No, it's the absorptive state, Matt.
Yeah,
not the post-absorptive state.
So but technically, it's still post-absorption.
Yeah, that's why I never used that
It's term. A bad term, isn't it?
Yes.
Because I was thinking the same thing. It's like, you'd never get to that point if you didn't absorb.
Exactly.
So it has to be post-absorption.
Yeah, and absorption tells you nothing about metabolism.
No.
So fed state or postprandial, which means after eating.
We'll do that. We'll do that one.
Yeah, so this is basically the time period after you've had a meal, which is generally, you know, immediately after the meal to 6 hours-ish after a meal. This is what's happening metabolically, biochemically in your body. And that's what we're going to focus on. So,
Before we get too far ahead, this episode's brought to listeners by
The Biochemical Society.
So this is our second episode.
It is. We got a grant from the Biochemical Society. So
in the UK, right?
Yes. So we appreciate that. You'll see that there's a little Biochemical Society logo
on the video.
But yes, thank you for that. We are focusing on some biochemistry-based topics, which includes metabolism, and I think any biology student needs to understand not just multiple aspects of metabolism, but fed versus fasting. So we will be doing a fasting state episode as well. But in this fed state, so can I first define what
Please
I think
do.
Fed state is? So the fed state or postprandial state is referring to the time after eating when the food that's ingested, or I should say the energy ingested as food, exceeds the energy released by oxidation. Now, when I use the term oxygen, do you remember in undergraduate science when, so you would have done similar to me, a science degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you would have done biochem and metabolism, and you would have heard terms like oxidation and reduction.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did not understand what that meant for at least 1 to 2 semesters, because it was sort of just a word that was dropped in as, oh, then that's oxidized to create this. So you don't even think about the oxidation. You just go, oh, that turns to that.
Yeah.
And you forget you don't really care what oxidation means, or that's reduced to this. But it is important in this case because we're saying that, like I said, that the energy ingested as food exceeds the energy released by oxidation. So energy brought in exceeds energy made by
makes
the body,
sense.
Right?
Makes sense.
And oxidation is important for making ATP, which is the energy currency.
Yeah.
So oxidation refers to the loss of electrons. So I remembered that in my undergraduate and still now as LEO, L-E-O, that loss of electrons is oxidation.
Okay.
Right? And the gain of electrons is reduction. So I don't have a an acronym for that. You could say OR, GOR. No.
Gain of electrons.
GER, GER. Go. Gain of electrons, reduction, GER.
GOER. GOER.
GOER. Yeah, it could be. So LEO, loss of electrons. Now, when we talk about oxidation, we're predominantly talking about a couple of processes, which include glycolysis, Krebs cycle, but also the electron transport chain. Yeah. So these are oxidative processes occurring in which electrons are stolen from molecules, shuttled by carrying molecules to the mitochondria in the electron transport chain, where they use those electrons to help generate ATP. Right?
Yep.
And so that's the process of oxidation. So in this fed state, at the end of the day, the food taken in and the energy taken in exceeds the energy being made, which then makes you think, well, what do we do with this excess energy? And the answer is we store it.
Yes.
And that's what this metabolic state refers to, is the storage state. So storing energy
in
the form of molecules.
Anabolism?
It would be predominantly anabolism, so building things up. You could justify and say that. If we think about the three macromolecules that we refer to.
Or macronutrients. What's a better term?
Well, nutrients, if you're referring to it within its ability. Its caloric capacity or its ability to maintain.
Molecules are just from a chemical standpoint.
That's right. So we'll say nutrients.
Okay.
What are the three macronutrients?
Okay, carbohydrates, proteins, fats.
Okay, perfect. And then we break them down respectively into what?
So the carbohydrates generally will get broken down into the monosaccharides.
Yep, so simple sugars.
Yep, and then the proteins are broken down amino acids.
Yep.
And the fats will get broken down into fatty acids.
And glycerol.
And glycerol.
Yes.
But to get across the gut wall, it has to...
We'll talk about
it.
Okay. So that's good. So the monosaccharides, let's start with that. So broadly speaking, you'll ingest a meal.
Yep.
A delicious cheeseburger, as I always say.
But saying this, you could also be in this state if you were to just inject these same things straight into your blood.
Correct. But as we'll talk about, the physiological response can be different.
Okay.
So generally speaking, a lot of us don't intake our nutrients.
No, true. But I'm just thinking, if you're injections. In a patient and you're getting... Nutrition.
What's it called when you bypass the digestive tract?
Parenteral.
Yeah, parenteral.
Parenteral.
Yep. So not a parent.
No.
But parenteral. Yep. Pantera, we call it. So you ingest a cheeseburger, bite, chew. You got proteins, fats, carbs in that cheeseburger. Through the digestive tract, which we've done an episode on, you break those things up mechanically and chemically, and by the time you hit the duodenum, the small intestines, you've broken up those macronutrients into their relative micronutrients.
Yep.
So the monosaccharides, the amino acids, the fatty acids and glycerol, and then they get absorbed at the small intestines. Let's start by saying they get absorbed into the enterocytes, so the cells that line the small intestine wall.
Okay.
Now, are you happy if we start with carbohydrates?
Yep.
Okay. So carbohydrates, those monosaccharides that are being made, there's three major monosaccharides. Mm-hmm. What are they?
Well, by far the most abundant is glucose.
Yeah.
And in most cases, this is what we're going to refer to for the rest of this podcast, right?
Predominantly, yeah.
Because glucose is usually that monosaccharide of most abundance.
And it's the one that most of the tissues utilize in a process called glycolysis.
Mm. The other one is fructose, which I guess predominantly comes from more fruit-like carbohydrate sources, but
I mean, not entirely
accurate.
But yes.
Yep. And then we have galactose, which is more dairy-based.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's fair to say. So glucose, fructose, and galactose. They're the monosaccharides that we've produced. They get absorbed into the enterocyte, the cell line in the gut wall, and they get absorbed through the enterocyte into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
So the bloodstream of the gut, so basically whatever gets absorbed through the gut into the blood, that's not recognized as a systemic circulation, is it? So that
not
doesn't
yet.
Just go straight to all the tissues of the body.
No.
It's a dedicated blood supply, a venous system, right? That goes where?
Oh, so this is called the portal.
system.
Yeah. Got another name?
Portal venous system.
Portal venous. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
The portal system, which basically drains. So the whole the whole length of the intestinal tract, bar in the top part of the esophagus and the last third of your rectum, would get taken.
Mine specifically?
No.
Oh, okay.
Everyone's?
Yep. I was going to say,
How did you know that? Gets drained to the liver, which makes sense The liver is kind of the gatekeeper for the systemic circulation, and it wants to just ensure anything that you've ingested.
Or detoxifies, right?
Well, it can do that or just inactivate it, and so potentially save you if you've ingested things you shouldn't have.
Yes, which is probably what you do very often. I've seen what you eat. So luckily you've got a giant liver that can
look after. Massive amounts of smooth endoplasmic reticulum.
Ooh, okay. Don't know why you said it like that. So if we first start with glucose, and then we can talk about fructose and galactose, the glucose will be now in our bloodstream. So we ingest a heavy meal, and now we've got glucose.
What, the cheeseburgers?
Yeah.
Weight-wise, it's...
Well, okay. It's a carbohydrate-dense meal, okay. Let's say. And now we've got huge amounts of glucose floating through the bloodstream. Now, importantly, something which I should have said earlier, which I think is really interesting, is that when we look at the cost of this postprandial or fed state, in which the amount of energy we take in through the food we've ingested exceeds the amount of energy we're producing through oxidation, there is something that we call the resting metabolic rate. Right, which is basically the amount of energy we use just to maintain existence.
Right, so this is just to keep the individual cells functioning.
Yeah.
Or their kind of metabolic activity.
That's right.
Just to do...
Just, you decide to stay home, lay on the couch, watch TV, chill, not do much. How much energy is required for you to do that?
Just to keep it alive, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the resting metabolic rate. So... Interestingly, simply the process of digestion and absorption, so breaking proteins, fats, carbs down into those micronutrients and absorbing them into the bloodstream, just to that point, increases your resting metabolic rate by 20 to 25%.
Right.
At least for the 90 minutes after a meal. Yeah. Right.
So is that where they say things like, if you ingest things like celery, let's say, because it's got no calorie in it or barely any, then you'll... essentially losing calories because you are expending 20% more energy on breaking this thing down that's not giving you any energy.
Yes. I'd say, there'd be relatively few products we ingest where it's not – I mean
– You don't get anything.
The body wouldn't dedicate an additional 20-25% of energy if it wasn't getting that plus more back.
Mm.
But, yes, that's exactly right. Interestingly, that's just breaking it down, digesting and absorbing it, but – there's also a cost to storing this energy, which is what we're going to focus on today, right?
Which makes sense.
So, for example, we tend to store most of our products as glycogen. So glucose gets stored as glycogen. And
so
fats.
It's a complex carbohydrate.
And fats get stored as triglycerides or triacylglycerides, sometimes termed TAGs.
TAGs.
Right? So they're the two major types of storage. We do have proteins.
And proteins.
But... mostly in this state, it's going to be
those two.
Yes, that's right. Glycogen and TAGs. This costs about 5%. So of that meal that you ate, 5% of the energy from that meal will be dedicated just to store glycogen and triglycerides each.
Yep.
Right? But proteins, if you want to store amino acids as proteins, which we also do, that costs 25%. Of the meal, energy of the meal you just took in.
And that assumption is the meal that you just had would have to be protein rich.
Correct. Yes, it has to be a protein dense meal. And so this
is... Because I'm imagining that you can't really store carbohydrates as proteins. You'd need amino acids in the meal.
Yes.
Or you'd need to at least pull it from somewhere to store it as, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. So... 25%, this is one of the reasons why you might hear some people, particularly online, saying if you have more protein in your meal, you will be burning more energy from simply just digesting, ingesting, and storing a protein-rich meal. Give me one sec.
So with that said then, does that the body has more efficient pathways for storing or creating anabolism? Then would it, the assumption be, or just a hypothesis, then it's not an efficient way of storing energy?
What?
Proteins. Because to liberate energy from proteins is also, would it be the same in the opposite? I know we're going to probably talk about that in the fasting state.
Yeah.
But utilizing proteins, thus amino acids, to make into energy would also be less efficient.
Yeah, I'd say that that's fair because when we go to make energy, we mainly utilize glycogen to make glucose and use glucose, or we use triglycerides to make fatty acids and glycerol for energy. You know, the amino acid utilization, or breaking proteins down to amino acids, so proteolysis, is but it wants to be our last resort.
Yeah.
Right?
But it does do it. I always thought it does that. Do it. I always thought that, that it's really the last ditch effort to keep you alive. But saying that, as we will cover this when we do the fasting one.
It's always happening.
It's always happening. But just maybe to not some degree. But not to the extent of just fully emaciating you from your muscle stores.
No, that's right. And it's important to say that there's interconversion happening as well, right? So turning a carbohydrate into a triglyceride or turning an amino acid into glycogen, right? This happens all the time.
Yeah.
This costs energy. That interconversion costs 25% as well of the meal's energy that you just took in. Yep. So all these things are important. All right, so we did that. We've eaten our carbohydrate, heavy meal. The glucose is flooding our bloodstream, so our blood glucose levels have gone up. So generally after a fast, so let's just say fasting throughout the night, which I would say most of us do unless you get up to have a midnight snack or whatever it might be, you've fasted for around about 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Your blood glucose levels after that fast will generally sit around, what, three to six millimoles per litre?
Probably, yeah. Let's call it 3 to 4.
Okay, 3 to 4 millimoles per litre. So that's the fasting glucose. Then now that you've ingested a carb-rich meal, that bumps up. You know, it could go up to 10.
6 to 10, yeah.
Yeah, 6 to 10 millimoles per litre. Now, importantly, and if you don't have a strong online presence on social media, but there's people who don't have diabetes, for example, who are wearing these diabetic
monitors,
blood glucose monitors, right? Like long-term, real-time blood glucose monitors to measure their insulin. And it's, in a way, it's pointless because the fluctuations of glucose is normal.
Yeah.
Right? These people are going, oh my God, I just ate this particular food and my blood glucose has gone up to 10 millimoles per litre. Look at that that glucose spike. It's going to result. Who cares?
What's meant to happen.
It's what's meant to happen. What could be a problem is if it goes up and stays up or goes higher.
Or goes too high.
Because remember, it's not about these extremes that your body undergoes. It's how well your body goes back to normal or within normal ranges from those extremes.
Yeah.
It's just like saying, oh, I'm going to go out on a 40-degree day and do some exercise and take my temperature. Oh, my God, I'm above 37 degrees. You know, I'm 39 degrees. It's like, well, yeah, it's hot. You did exercise. If it stays at that, then that's the problem. But luckily you sweat, your blood vessels dilate. You know, all those things happen to cool you back down. So if the homeostatic mechanisms don't work, when the disease state rises, right? So again, measuring blood glucose through transient events, pointless.
Oh, another good one would be blood pressure, right?
Yes.
So if you start exercising and your blood pressure goes up to 180, that would seem pathological.
That's right.
But it's appropriate for the situation.
Yeah, so it's appropriate for you. If you woke up in the morning after an 8-hour fast and your blood glucose was 10 millimoles per litre, okay. Question mark, right? Go see someone. That is an important point. So you've had this meal, blood glucose levels have risen up, hyperglycemia, that's what this is called. And thankfully for us, this hyperglycemia will trigger a number of homeostatic events to try and bring us back into normoglycemia.
Yeah. And would you say that ultimately the main reason why you want it to stay in that normal range is predominantly for your brain? Because you may say, oh, well, why do you want to always maintain it at a steady state? If you don't have enough glucose all the time, then your brain is going to really struggle to function. I know it does have the ability to utilize ketones or other metabolites, but glucose is its preference, right?
Yeah.
And if you go into a hypo, even transiently, then you run the risk of having neurological issues like fainting, seizures, coma. And that's obviously the problem with a hypo.
Yeah.
And
we. But then wouldn't the brain love to have a hyperglycemic?
No, but then you with the hyper, so you're going too far, you would then get problems with the kidneys not being able to regulate that amount. And then you're going to lose a lot of sugar in urine, lose water, then go into hypotensive and then shock state, and then you're in trouble.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that's part of it. I would say another part is that, as we know, glucose products that stay too long in the bloodstream damage
blood vessels. Yeah.
Long term. So that's not anything anybody who doesn't have diabetes should worry about, but it's an important consideration as to why the body likes to maintain a normal glycemic range of, you know, 3 to 4, 3 to 6 millimoles
per
liter.
4 to 6-ish.
The body has employed three main mechanisms, right? After you've ingested a meal, a high carbohydrate-rich meal, to maintain normal glycemic range. First is it suppresses the liver's ability to produce glucose.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's no point. We've got heaps now in the bloodstream. It stimulates the liver to uptake that glucose, and it stimulates the peripheral tissues of the body, particularly muscle and fat, mainly muscle, to uptake glucose as well.
And I'd add to the first one, which is stop liver putting out more glucose.
Yeah.
I would also add stop particularly fat and muscle to also put things out that could be made into glucose.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's fair. So we're now in a state where we've got heaps of nutrients. We don't need to make any more or mobilize any more. We need to bring it into tissues to bring the blood glucose levels back down. Use it if we need it for energy in the moment, or store the excess. That's what we're going to think about. And so if we think about how this works, it's mainly orchestrated by insulin.
Yeah, but pretty much one, unlike you'll see with the fasting state, which has a multitude of different hormones, pretty much in this state, it's all insulin.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's all insulin. And so the blood glucose levels will trigger, as it goes past the pancreas, it will trigger beta cells.
So I know we've said this before, but I can't remember the answer we came up with.
Yeah.
If all the gut is draining
to the portal system,
to the liver, my thought is it's bypassing the pancreas, and then the pancreas has to wait till it gets it from a systemic point of view. Is that right?
Correct. But think about this. As the portal system is draining the gut, and you've got really high levels of glucose now in the gut, the liver, which doesn't need insulin, will suck up about a third of that glucose without stimulating the release of insulin.
Yep.
The remaining two-thirds-ish, one-quarter of that glucose will then move into the systemic circulation, and then that will trigger the pancreas to release insulin. And then that insulin will now be spread throughout the entire systemic circulation, because it's a hormone that travels through the bloodstream, and then it will have its global effects on all the tissues.
Okay.
So, yes, you're quite...
Whilst you're saying that, I thought of another one, though.
Yeah.
We know... So, insulin
comes
from the pancreas.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else you want to talk about that, or in terms of what cells?
You got beta cells, which are sitting in little islets, little areas that have beta and alpha cells. They're basically the endocrine tissue
of the pancreas. The whole pancreas... I don't know how big it is.
About that big.
Give us something, the real world example.
Pair of scissors, because that's what I'm looking at right now, but they can, half of this microphone, but not solid.
Yeah.
Yeah?
About that.
Yeah. So maybe like an iPhone, but not that shape.
Not that really wide.
It's a tadpole shape, not that wide, maybe a little bit smaller than your hand in length.
But just
more
a bit thinner. Yeah, a bit narrow.
Looks pretty innocuous.
So of that block of tissue, the pancreas just means all tissue, all flesh. That's what pancreas means. All flesh.
Okay.
2% of it is islet, which is so endocrine. So 98% of it is for its digestive function.
Right, so releasing digestive enzymes into
and bicarbonate. Ducts. That's right.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, so of 2%, the majority of that is beta cells. So telling you the importance of
2% of the 2%.
No. The majority of the 2% are beta cells.
Oh, okay.
Okay, which is telling you the importance of insulin. But the other cells being the alpha cells, which is glucagon, which we're going to cover when we do the fasting.
Yep.
Delta cells, which is somatostatin. And F cells, which is a more recent discovery.
Okay.
Now, interestingly, of the islet cells, which is only 2% of the pancreas, it gets 20% of the blood flow of the pancreas.
So which makes sense.
It gets as much blood flow proportionally as the myocardium.
Right. So, wow. So it really can bathe the tissue so it can go, all right, what's the blood glucose level or what's the nutrient level of this of this system?
Now, the beta cell, which is the insulin-releasing cell of the pancreas, like its most strongest activator to release insulin is the presence of a glucose.
Sure.
However, there are other mechanisms.
Yes.
One is neural.
Yeah.
So this is usually the autonomic nervous system will secrete insulin, both from the vagus but also beta adrenergic will also tell it to release insulin. Okay. But alpha is inhibition.
Yeah.
So it's kind of saying
parasympathetic
predominantly.
Predominantly.
Yeah. But if you're in a stress situation, you may want to also utilize insulin whilst you've got a huge abundance of sugar in your blood, but not to the point that you're going to give yourself a hypo. So that's why alpha
strongly,
Well, it's going to be probably if you're in a fight and flight situation, there's going to be a balance between the beta and the alpha.
Yeah,
but I think the alpha prevents you going into a hypo because you don't want to have that when you're in exercising or something.
Yes.
Anyway, but there are also humoral and what would you call it? Autocrine effects, so local effects, and I think we're going to get to this, but let's talk about it now.
Cool, you undercut my story. So I told you I wanted to tell this story.
So the point I'm making,
The point I'm making is
if we're saying you got to wait for glucose in your blood to be high enough to then stimulate insulin, that you would think, oh, that's a bit slow if the liver's already getting glucose before it gets insulin, right? But because we're mostly going to be getting glucose through what we eat, we've already got the effect of the ingestion of it. So the idea of we're just eating, the taste.
Well, again, undercutting my story.
Do you want to take over?
Well, it's no point now.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is there's already insulin being released to a small degree before the food gets to the digested point.
Yes. So what I was going to say, which I was going to try and nicely lead into, was that if you were to take a meal in, a carbohydrate-rich meal, and by the time it went through the digestive tract and the glucose was absorbed into the bloodstream, if you were to measure the concentration of the glucose in that bloodstream, it would, let's just say it's 8 millimoles per litre. If you were to inject glucose into the bloodstream directly, intravenously, so that the blood plasma was also 8 millimoles per litre, they differentially stimulate the pancreas to release insulin. And so that's an interesting point because, like you were saying, as you digest, the process of digestion of carbohydrates will stimulate and release a range of other chemicals throughout this process, which can potentiate the pancreas to release insulin. And so one of those is GLP-1, which is called glucagon, which is interestingly called glucagon-like peptide 1. It doesn't work like glucagon. It stimulates insulin itself. So it potentiates the pancreas to release more insulin. It also reduces gastric emptying. It goes to the brain and makes you feel more satiated and less hungry. And so, you know, this type of chemical is a brilliant chemical to be utilized as a drug for diabetes and for weight loss and has been because it's called
GLP-1.
Yes, it's called Ozempic. And so
that's its brand name, but I think it's a semaglutide.
It's
as a generic term, right?
GLP-1 agonist.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly how it functions. It potentiates insulin. And so you don't get that potentiation happening when glucose is mobilized directly into the bloodstream without going through that the gastrointestinal tract. And so the importance of that is when you are in a fight or flight response, a stress response, and you've got, you know, cortisol mobilizing stimulating the liver,
yeah,
and noradrenaline stimulating the liver to release glucagon as glucose or undergoing gluconeogenesis to basically mobilize glucose into the bloodstream. Because you get stressed, it mobilizes nutrients so that you can utilize them. You'd think, like you said earlier, that would then stimulate the pancreas to release heaps of insulin, but it doesn't, because it doesn't release those other chemicals like GLP-1 to potentiate the pancreas.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that's...
So you get a more profound insulin...
release through ingestion.
Right. And the point there is there are other... And this kind of goes to the humeral or... What's the localized, not autocrine, but...
Paracrine?
Paracrine. You get this paracrine humeral effect from the food in the gut as well that makes the release more efficient.
Yes, and to a lesser degree, certain amino acids can stimulate the pancreas to release insulin, and so can fatty acids.
So could that then, if you were to have these artificial sweeteners,
yep,
you may not know this, but just to work off first principles, do you think by having some of those artificial sweeteners, because you are still getting the taste of sweet in your mouth, then you potentially have a neurological response to it, as well as these local paracrine effects. Do you think that would then release insulin, but you're getting no calories?
Yeah, it's a good question. Without knowing, like you said, I'm sure people know the answer to this. I would assume that you would still get some degree of insulin release through those other effects, but they wouldn't be necessarily mediated by, you know, glucose binding because there's no glucose. So you wouldn't get as high of an insulin release, and you obviously wouldn't get the blood glucose spike either. What that then means clinically, health-wise?
Not sure.
Not sure. Not going to touch it.
So back with
it. Lane Norton has a PhD in nutrition science. I think that's correct, or at least biochemistry. I know he's on social media, done a number of posts and podcasts talking about exactly that, artificial sweeteners and their role with blood glucose and insulin. I would say he's probably a better resource to get that specific information from.
So back to Ozempic for one second.
Yeah.
They're a Denmark company.
Yes, Danish.
Yeah. And is it true that they earned more profit than the whole GDP of Denmark?
Correct. Yeah. Yes, which blows my mind. They're worth more than the country that they reside in.
Wow.
So that's interesting. Another thing that's interesting is I was talking to the dean of my med school who's also an anaesthetist. So she works one day a week as an anaesthetist in addition to being the dean. I don't know how she finds the time, but pretty cool. She was telling me not yesterday but the day before that – because so many people are on Ozempic now and we have very few studies relating to so you know that people need to fast prior to surgery,
yeah,
right? Ozempic reduces gastric emptying, which is one of the ways in which it makes you feel more satiated or full. Reducing gastric emptying means food stays in your gut for longer, or at least your stomach for longer.
Mm.
And so they don't know how long a patient should be off Ozempic for.
Oh, they go off it before they go into surgery.
Correct. Because if they're on the Ozempic and they may have fasted, but they've still got contents in their stomach,
yeah,
the problem is aspiration.
Yeah,
vomiting. Right? Because you paralyze people's ability to breathe autonomously through certain types of operations, and an anaesthetist needs to be able to,
Intubate.
Intubate, right? Put a tube down and breathe on their behalf. One of the biggest issues with all that is aspiration of foodstuffs into the lungs.
Yeah, so you
can't cough it out.
The anesthetic causes a vomit.
Yeah.
At the same time as causing the loss of the gag reflex.
Yeah. Yes. So she's saying that it's really a tricky place at the moment trying to figure out how that works, particularly when there's so many people on a Ozempic. So I thought that was
very interesting.
All right. So carb-heavy meal, glucose enters the bloodstream, specifically the portal system. Generally speaking, the liver has first dibs on that glucose.
Yeah.
Takes about a third to a quarter of the glucose straight away. The rest jumps into the systemic circulation and will be delivered to the other tissues. However, the insulin is required for those other tissues to take it up. But before we go to those tissues, I just want to talk about – because the liver's working independently of insulin at the moment, I just want to talk about very quickly what the liver itself does with the glucose.
Okay, all right.
So once the glucose is taken up in the liver after a meal, generally speaking, some of it's going to be utilized under the glycolytic pathway, where basically glucose gets changed through a number of steps into pyruvate. In that process, a little bit of ATP or energy is produced.
Yeah.
You produce a couple of molecules of NADH, which are carrier molecules for electrons. So they basically tear from the glucose or the metabolites of glucose, both electrons and hydrogen ions, and hold onto them. That's what NAD plus does.
Okay.
Grabs hydrogens and electrons, holds onto it as NADH. It transports that to the electron transport chain to make ATP.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So it will undergo the glycolytic pathway, but I'd say the majority, because you're already exceeding the energy demands, will undergo the process of glycogenesis, which is creating glycogen.
Okay.
Now, glycogen is pretty much snapping together glucose molecules, specifically glucose 6-phosphate.
Yeah, so if you would think a very common way for us to get glucose in our diet is through grainy, starch-based foods.
Yep.
Those particular foods are a complex glucose arrangement.
Yep.
Which is very similar to how we store these carbohydrates as glycogen. So they're almost like a tree with main stems, but coming off the stems are smaller and smaller branches.
Yep.
So they're just necklaces of glucose and glucose and glucose and glucose and another branch, glucose, glucose, glucose. And by making the tree or the bush, whatever you want to call it, more and more dense, it just means you've got more glucose packed into that molecule.
Yeah. So it's, you know, Lego blocks snapping together of glucose, but it's not glucose directly. It's glucose 6-phosphate. It turns to glucose 6-phosphate first, and then it can get snapped together.
Yeah.
Or at least the glucose 6-phosphate turns to glucose 1-phosphate, and then that gets snapped together. So to be more accurate, glucose 1-phosphate turns into glycogen. Now, there's actually two glycogenic pathways to make glycogen. So the two pathways are the you've got the direct pathway and the indirect pathway. So, for example, in the direct pathway, you have a meal, and you are storing the glucose from the meal that you've eaten. Simple. The indirect pathway is if you've fasted overnight, 8 hours, throughout that process, your liver will create glucose from non-glucose substrates like fatty acids and amino acids.
So that's called gluconeogenesis.
It's called gluconeogenesis. And that glucose that you've made will be floating through the bloodstream.
Yeah.
But then when you eat in the morning, you need to store it again.
Yeah.
So storing the gluconeogenic glucose is called the indirect pathway. But at the end of the day, you end up needing to store that glucose as glycogen. And the liver is extremely efficient at doing it. So the glycogen stores peak at around about 4 to 6 hours after a meal. So when we ingest, let's say, 3 meals a day, if they're spaced 4 to 6 hours apart, you could argue that basically all day your liver is taking glucose and storing it as glycogen until around about midnight. And at midnight, this is when you start to undergo glycogenolysis. So then the liver breaks down the stored glycogen to release more glucose. So around about 50% of your glucose comes from glycogenolysis after midnight. This is during that fasting.
Because it's an easier way to liberate the energy.
That's right. But then you've got another 50% comes from gluconeogenesis. So you would think that I've just stored all this glycogen from the glucose I've had all day through my meals. I'll use it all up overnight through my fast. But you don't use all of it up.
No.
Of the glucose that you require, 50% of it is taken from the stored glycogen, but the other 50% is made from amino acids and some fatty acids, or amino acids and glycerol.
And to what point can you store to a maximum point, like a dam, and you've exceeded your ability to store glycogen in the liver?
In regards to quantity?
Quantity, yeah.
To be honest, I didn't know.
Does it get to the point where it goes, we're maxed out, we've filled up our cells enough, now we just have to push it all down into fatty acid storage?
I think we spoke about it in our glucose metabolism episode. We spoke about how many grams of glucose the liver can store.
Because that's essentially just going to be in the cytosol of the hepatocytes, right?
Yeah, just fills it up.
Yeah.
Just fills it up. Interestingly, because the liver has an enzyme called citrate lyase, this enzyme converts glucose into fatty acids. So we said that the glucose that enters the liver can undergo glycolytic pathway, make ATP.
Yeah.
Most is stored as glycogen, but simultaneously, it can be turned into fatty acids.
Yes.
Now, again, the preference is probably glycogen storage.
Yeah.
However, it can be funneled off into fatty acid synthesis.
Okay.
If it contains the enzyme citrate lyase, which the liver has in high quantities. So the liver can make fatty acids. Now, what happens then is that the liver cells or the hepatocytes will convert these fatty acids to and glycerol that's available to triglycerides, to triacyl glycerides.
Yeah.
This is where the liver packages them into things called VLDLs, so very low-density lipoproteins, and it can export it into the bloodstream. So this is VLDLs, packages of basically
fatty acids
and glycerol that
to be used somewhere else,
that the liver has explicitly made.
Yes,
that can be used elsewhere.
Okay,
we're going to get to. There's another package system which occurs when, so this is when you make a lot of the time the fatty acids from the triglycerides, right? The fatty acids, sorry, from the glycerol. Can happen from dietary fats, but I'm saying in the liver, VLDLs. That's all I'll say about that because I'm going to talk more about it when
we get the fatty acids.
Fatty acids. But so is there anything you wanted to add?
I think we just summarize. The take-home point here is when the liver's receiving so much glucose from your meal and there is insulin in the blood, the effect that these two together will have are four main things in the hepatocyte.
Yeah.
As you said, one is to store glycogen.
Yeah.
One is to produce fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a smaller degree of protein metabolism.
Yeah.
So you will still some of that as proteins. But we're also wanting to control but drive glycolysis in a way that it is powering the fatty acid metabolism.
Yep.
But also to keep the cell energized, because a lot of the ATP in the cell at this point is regulating all these mechanisms.
Absolutely. Yeah, the more energy you have, the less likely it wants to make more energy.
Now, interestingly, again, going to your fatty acid synthesis, when insulin is present, because sometimes what you'll find if the liver's getting a lot of fatty acids, it may kind of overwhelm the fatty acid synthase steps, and it may say, well, we're getting too much fatty acids, let's shuffle them into ketones.
Yeah.
So they kind of got to move it from the cytosol back into the mitochondria.
Oh, we'll talk about that when we get to...
But when you've got insulin, it blocks that pathway.
Yeah.
So it can't... So the liver can't make ketones with the presence of insulin.
Yeah.
And so you do see this as a problem in diabetes, that, say, a type 1 diabetic who has no insulin anymore, they can't produce this, okay? And so they have this issue, right? So they produce a ton of ketones.
Yes.
And that's going to be their problem because they haven't got insulin.
Yeah.
They can't do this other alternative pathway. So they're pumping out huge amounts of ketones, which then leads to a state called diabetes ketoacidosis.
That's right.
And that could be life-threatening. So that's another thing I just thought that was interesting too, the way that the liver is processing sugar or glucose into fatty acid is to store for itself, but also then to send it out into the blood, which can be sent to the muscle for energy or for adipocytes or fat cells for storage.
And another thing to add is, you know, we said that the liver is insulin independent. It is insulin independent in regards to its ability to suck up glucose from the bloodstream, right? But insulin still works in the liver because it helps regulate
all these
pathways.
That's right.
So, an important enzyme used in glycogen synthesis, which is glycogen synthase, insulin stimulates. The enzyme that breaks glycogen into glucose to free it up is called glycogen phosphorylase. Insulin stimulates glycogen synthase and inhibits glycogen phosphorylase. Makes sense because it wants to store, right? It doesn't want to mobilize, wants to store. It also stimulates pyruvate dehydrogenase, which is an important enzyme to turn to make a pyruvate and then for the subsequent steps into acetyl-CoA in the Krebs cycle. So insulin does help regulate all these processes. So you could go, liver doesn't need insulin. Well, it might not for uptake, but it does for regulation.
That's right. And the final other one, which
feeds
is important.
Into what you were saying with insulin inhibits fatty acid synthesis.
Yeah. And the other one that's of real importance.
Not inhibits fatty acid synthesis, inhibits
ketone.
Ketone.
Is glucokinase.
Yep.
That is
one of the first steps.
So that's the first enzyme to go glucose to glucose 6-phosphate.
Yeah.
And so its insulin produces a lot of that enzyme, which helps drive either glycolysis or glycogen production.
Yeah.
But where the liver is different to muscle, it doesn't have glucokinase. And so what glucokinase does in the liver is
So the liver has glucokinase?
It does, yeah. Yeah. So it has the ability to not only go glucose to glucose 6-phosphate to be stored for glycogen or glycolysis, but it can also reverse it. So it can go glucose 6-phosphate back into glucose, shuffle it out into the blood. That's used for the body.
Yeah.
The muscle doesn't have that enzyme, so it doesn't liberate glucose 6-phosphate back to glucose for the body. It only uses it for itself.
Well, let's talk about muscle then. Actually, before we talk about muscle, I wanted to talk about fructose and galactose at the liver.
Okay.
Right? Because we've spoken about glucose. Let's talk about what
happens. The other carbohydrate.
Yeah, the others. And then we can move on to what glucose does at the muscle and then what it does at the fat cells. And then we can move on to the other ones. All right. So is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. So fructose, interestingly, its metabolism is different to glucose metabolism. It funnels into the glycolytic pathway, but at a different step. So importantly, one very important regulatory step in glycolysis is turning fructose 6-phosphate into fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. That's just a normal step of glycolysis where glucose undergoes all these steps. One of them is fructose 6-phosphate into fructose 1,6-bisphosphate.
So that's a phosphatase step?
This is where you use an enzyme called phosphofructokinase.
And that's also using energy.
Yes, and it's an important step because it's a regulatory step, meaning that there are a number of different things that can inhibit it or activate it. So, for example, if you've got a lot of glucose in the liver cell and that liver is making a lot of that glucose into ATP or energy, the ATP levels go up. In addition to that, if a lot of the glucose has been undergoing the glycolytic pathway and then undergoes the Krebs cycle, a lot of citrate is going to be available because that's part of the Krebs cycle. Citrate goes up. So you've got both high levels of ATP and citrate. They inhibit the phosphofructokinase 1 enzyme, PFK1. That's the enzyme that turns the fructose-6-phosphate into fructose-1,6-bisphosphate.
Yeah.
If it inhibits that step, it's basically saying, I've got enough energy. Yeah. This is the liver. I've got enough energy. I don't need to turn any more glucose into ATP because we've got heaps. Go away. Don't bring any more glucose into the liver. Go into the systemic circulation. Go to the other tissues. Let the muscle use you. Let the fat tissue use you. Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. That's great. That's what it needs to do. Helps regulate energy production because otherwise it's just going to produce too much. It can be damaging. With fructose will jump into the glycolytic pathway downstream of phosphofructokinase 1, the one that can get regulated by ATP and citrate. As it goes in and jumps into the cycle, the enzyme that it uses is not regulated by ATP and citrate. So regardless of the liver's energy levels, if you've got high levels of fructose coming in, it will jump into the glycolytic pathway.
Okay.
And the liver can't go, hey, fructose, stop, go somewhere else. The liver is basically the only place that fructose is really getting metabolized.
Yep.
So what it then does is goes, well, I can't say go away like I do to glucose. I've got to do something with it. I'm not going to make ATP because I've got heaps. I'm going to have to store it as fatty acids. And it stimulates lipogenesis, the production of fat storage.
But saying that, it would have to still go through those subsequent steps of glycolysis to get to pyruvate though, right?
Yes.
It can't kind of just jump and miss a whole lot of stuff. It still has to keep...
Yes, but it's closer to the end of the glycolytic pathway where fructose jumps in. And so it funnels it off for lipogenesis. And because this is happening solely in the liver, you increase the amount of fat being produced in the liver. And this can result in, if somebody is ingesting high amounts of fructose, which, you know, let's just say like soft drinks and high fructose corn syrups, right?
So soft drinks would be sucrose, which would be a glucose and a fructose in it. Mm-hmm. So like cane sugar.
This and that high fructose corn syrup, this can lead to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and has also contributed to the obesity epidemic in countries like the United States and possibly other countries, Western countries now as well. But that's what fructose does. Now, this isn't to say, because I know how people work, I'm going to avoid all fructose. This is when the amount of fructose is overwhelming and the energy demands are being met already through other means.
Yeah.
So you're basically taking in way excess calories or energy in the mode of fructose.
And they're usually in a situation where it's highly processed. So you have kind of your standard type of food where you can gauge where it came from, right?
Yeah.
You know, you have orange juice. You have an idea that's just been squeezed from an orange. Then you have more processed, which is harder to know where it came from, like, say, table sugar. And then you have ultra processed, which I've always been told ultra processed is food that you would have no ability to be able to make it in your kitchen.
But I don't know. I mean, as far as I know, fructose is fructose is fructose.
Yeah.
So regardless of whether it's highly processed or not, I think the thing is you don't know how much is in the food stuff.
Yeah.
So something highly processed could be a little bar, but it could be jam-packed.
That's right. But what I mean is, like, if you went back to its non-processed form and said, here, consume this in its...
You couldn't pack that much fructose.
That's right.
You'd
have to eat like 10, let's say 10 cobs of corn.
Yeah.
Which no one would do, right?
Well, I'm sure there are some people.
But you get my point, right?
I get your point. Yeah. Processing it allows you to pack more in, basically, is what you're saying. And so, again, I'm not saying avoid fructose. A lot of fructose is in fruit. Sperm love fructose.
Yeah.
It's the primary energy source for sperm. But okay, anyway, so.
What a tangent.
Oh, okay. Now, galactose. Galactose is pretty simple. Galactose enters the glycolytic pathway.
Unintelligent.
Yes. Galactose is the mat of metabolism.
Monosaccharides.
Yep. It enters the glycolytic pathway very close to glucose.
And so much higher up.
Yeah, much higher up.
Glucose 6-phosphate maybe?
Yeah. So what it ends up doing, and I've got it here just so I want to be as accurate
as possible. So this is dairy sugars.
Yes.
So if you were to consume milk.
Yep. That's one source. It's not the only source.
Just as an example,
yeah.
You would liberate glucose and galactose
yep.
from lactose, let's say.
Yeah. And so galactose will jump in at glucose 1-phosphate. And then glucose, so you've got.
Glucose 1-phosphate.
Yeah. So listen, so you've got glucose goes to glucose 6. So if you're undergoing glycolysis to make energy, glucose goes to glucose 6-phosphate.
Yeah.
And glucose 6-phosphate ultimately goes to fructose 6-phosphate and then all these pathways, right? If you want to store glucose, it goes glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, then glucose 1-phosphate, then glycogen. Galactose comes in at glucose 1-phosphate, can be stored as glycogen
or
can
backwards.
Go to glucose 6-phosphate.
Yeah.
What that means is galactose, if you want to utilize it for ATP production through glycolytic means, it's slower.
Yeah, yeah, right? Makes sense.
It simply enters the glycolytic pathway more slowly. What does this mean? What are the implications of this? Probably negligible because at the end of the day, it's just another energy substrate and it just enters at another place and it enters more slowly. Again, the body has evolved mostly to utilize substrates probably in the lower abundant in the quantities that
it receives.
Yeah, which...
It makes sense. I mean, like if you're going to consume most of your meals in glucose form, you would really adapt to make your biochemical pathways most efficient for that.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. All right. Because we're still on carbohydrates and we're just
being I knew you'd do this.
I think we're covering it really nicely though. So what happens when you've got glucose at the muscle now? So I said that the liver takes up about 1/3 of the glucose floating through and the other 2/3 goes to the systemic circulation, gets divvied up. Most, and I think you said to me that I'm wrong here, but I'd like to know. As far as I'm aware, most of the remaining glucose in the systemic circulation gets pulled up by striated muscle.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. So like skeletal muscle, for example.
But saying that, with muscle,
we
didn't really talk about this, but you alluded to it, that we have glucose transporters, different glucose transporters throughout the body.
Correct.
Now,
which we did speak about in the glucose podcast.
Do you want to mention any more?
I know. All I was going to say is that the liver uses GLUT2, GLUT2.
And so does the pancreas.
And the pancreas. Muscle and adipose use GLUT4.
Now, this is where I was going to bring in that nuance. Muscle and adipocytes also has GLUT1.
Right.
But they will use it in a non-fed state, so without insulin. Or with lower abundance of insulin. So they are, with their GLUT1 receptor or GLUT1 transporter, they are always pulling glucose in a non-kind of...
So is it insulin independent?
Insulin independent.
Oh, it is. Okay.
That's right. Yeah. But when you have now insulin, and this is where we're talking about today, when you have insulin present, the effect that insulin, one of the effects that insulin has on a muscle cell is it will tell GLUT4 receptors or GLUT4 transporters to go from the cytoplasm up onto the muscle membrane.
Yeah.
So now you have this high abundance of GLUT4 transporters.
In the presence of insulin.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
So now you can really suck glucose out of the blood.
All right.
And this is why, and this is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Muscle is a real good sponge for pulling glucose out of the blood.
You heard it first here, folks. Muscle is a real good sponge for pulling glucose from the blood. It really is, because if you're somebody like me, where 99% of your body mass is muscle, it's going to be a great. It's going to be a great.
You should do an MRI scan.
No, there'd be too many anomalies. They'll be like, we've discovered that all of Michael's brain is muscle. All right, so the
meathead is his term.
So muscle will metabolize most of the glucose via the glycolytic pathway and then either oxidize those products, meaning, Krebs, electron transport chain, or this is different to the liver, the muscle will turn the products into either lactate or alanine.
All right. So, so with lactate, my assumption there would be that would be utilizing glucose in low levels of oxygen.
It is one way in which you can produce lactate.
Oh, so it's doing it all the time.
It's doing it all the time, yeah. So the recent evidence that's coming out is that, okay, under anaerobic conditions where oxygen is low, yeah, you do produce a predominance of lactate. So basically, glucose through the glycolytic pathway turns to pyruvate. Pyruvate, turn, you know, generally speaking, turns into acetyl-CoA, enters the Krebs cycle, spits out a bunch of products, goes to the electron transport chain. If oxygen is present, it's the final electron acceptor to make a butt ton of ATP. If you don't have enough oxygen available, it's not the final electron receptor. So everything backs up down the electron transport chain, backs up into the Krebs cycle, and can back up to pyruvate.
Yeah.
Right. And so what that means is pyruvate goes, what the hell do I do? And it goes, oh, I'm just going to turn into lactate.
Okay.
In that process of turning into lactate, lactate can leave the muscle cell.
So that could just be any time that pyruvate builds up in the muscle, you're going to get lactate released.
In the muscle, yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And the lactate can leave the muscle, which a number of those substrates can't really, leave the muscle. Oh, some can. and go to the liver, and the liver can turn lactate back into
glucose. So that's Cori cycle.
That's the Cori cycle, yeah.
So would that be considered gluconeogenesis?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. One of the major gluconeogenic substrates is lactate.
Okay.
Yeah. And the question might be, why? Why does it do that? This makes no sense. When pyruvate turns into lactate, it changes the availability of NAD plus and NADH, which can be fed back into the glycolytic pathway. So it means that you can then try and make more ATP from glycolysis. So that's one of the reasons. So lactate can be made as a product in muscle tissue. The other thing that can be made is alanine.
I always thought alanine was more in a fasting state.
Well, yes. That's why we're not going to focus on it because we're talking about fed state. But I would just say that it's one of the two destination products of glucose. It can produce alanine.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't necessarily say just a fasting state, but yes, it can create alanine.
But that, because that is a inhibitory molecule in glycolysis in the liver, isn't
it? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So,
but it will also shuffle some of the excessive glucose into its own fatty acid metabolism or production. So it can also store fatty acids as well.
Yeah, but it's not a major. It's not a major pathway for
not
muscle
a huge
tissue.
One.
Yeah,
okay.
I'll predominantly say that, you know, it's going to store it as glycogen, use it for energy, or effectively it's going to be shuttled off to lactate and sometimes alanine.
Okay.
Anything else about muscle? Oh, the other thing is exercise. We spoke about how maybe we didn't, but we have spoken about in the past that we said that you need insulin to translocate the GLUT4 receptor.
Yeah.
To the surface.
Because that's one.
To bring glucose in to the muscle cell. But exercise can do that too. And I think that's through adrenergic innovation, possibly. Maybe I'm making that up. But the mechanism in which exercise can do that, can't remember. But through exercise, insulin, independent of insulin, GLUT4 can translocate to the surface to allow for glucose intake, which is one of the reasons why they say to diabetics, exercise is great because it can help suck the excess glucose in your bloodstream into the muscle tissue, right?
Because it's a sponge, yeah.
There we go. All right, adipose tissue and carbohydrates. So even though adipocytes only constitute 10 to 15% of your total body mass, they metabolize really small amounts of
glucose.
And
that's going to do the same effect. So with insulin.
Insulin. Is there an H in there?
with insulin, the fat cell is the same as muscle cell. It normally, without insulin, it's relying on a GLUT1 transporter.
Yeah.
But with the presence of insulin, it then, what do you call it, translocates.
Yeah.
So already.
Is that right?
Well, it's basically endocytosis. Right?
Endocytosis.
Exocytosis.
I think it's translocates.
So my assumption would be. I'm happy to be corrected here.
Yeah.
The effect of insulin within these respective cells, mm-hmm. muscle and fat cells, yeah. is it would increase the gene expression of these transporter proteins, but they would also tell these already created transporters, which are in their own vesicles, to come up from the cytoplasm and fuse into the membrane.
I think it's predominantly the latter.
Yeah, because this is where insulin insensitivity comes about.
Mm.
Because if you have, I read something crazy like only really 5% of the transporters are utilized on the membrane.
Right.
So
where else are they utilized?
Well, it's just saying that you've got way more transporters than you need.
Okay.
And so.
So regulating its transcription might not be the major.
No, actually, not the transporter, sorry, the insulin receptor on these cells.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so therefore you've got an overabundance of insulin receptors on these types of tissues.
Yeah.
Now, the way it would respond to it if you're not needing them is to down-regulate them.
Sure.
Okay, now in potential states of diabetes, you become insensitive, at least type 2, mm-hmm. you become insensitive to your insulin. Mm. So therefore, you are kind of down-regulating the effects of this receptor, mm. and therefore these cells become less sensitive.
Yeah, so before when you said down-regulate it when you don't need it, I think that's a bit confusing. I think what you meant is what you've just said now, is that if you're saturating the membrane with insulin, it will go, I don't need as many receptors.
Yeah, yeah.
So it down-regulates the receptors in that instance.
Yeah, that's right.
And that makes sense because that then leads to that insensitivity that you're saying, yeah.
And then as a result, more glucose stays off in the blood.
Yeah,
and that,
over time, especially once the insulin becomes less.
And that's a side effect of early stages of diabetes.
Yeah. I've got an interesting point here, unless you wanted to add something on that point.
Well, the only other thing I was going to ask you is, I know we're going to get to this, and we're going to, when we talk about the fat cell and it's also uptake in the VLDLs and the fatty acids that you've just taken from your meal.
Mm.
But am I right by assuming that the only real thing that the fat cell does with glucose, obviously it will energize itself with ATP, but once that's made, all the rest of the glucose is just made into glycerol?
A glycerol substrate, yes, which was what I was going to move on to. So perfect.
Oh, okay.
So this is the what I thought was interesting is that I told you that the liver has an enzyme called citrate lyase. Do you remember what I said citrate lyase does?
Yeah, it spits off an intermediate into the fatty acid.
From what's the original?
Acetylcholine.
Well, glucose. It can help take glucose that's been brought in and ultimately turn it into fatty acids.
But it still has to go through all those steps of glycolysis into acetylcholine
mm-hmm.
to then do it, right?
Yeah. But without citrate lyase, it doesn't
happen. Do that.
Now, interestingly, and I thought this was odd, adipocytes don't really have much citrate lyase. So adipocytes, which you think would be the primary cell that could do this, they can't turn glucose into fatty acids.
Okay.
So what they end up doing is they use glucose as the starting material for glycerol 3-phosphate, which is the backbone, can be used as a backbone, like glycerol, to create the triacylglycerides or the triglycerides, the tags.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting because the liver has high abundance of citrate lyase. They can generate fatty acids from glucose and they generate triacylglycerides. They are what are exported in packages called VLDLs, which jump into the bloodstream. We'll get to that when we talk about fats, I think.
The only thing that's novel to the adipocyte that the other cells that we've spoken about doesn't happen with insulin, this one that's particular to the lipocyte, is that an effect of insulin on this cell is it produces an enzyme called lipoprotein lipase, which makes
But we should talk about that when we talk about fats.
Yeah, but it's still an effect of insulin on the cell. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes.
Okay. But you're right. It's to do with.
But that's usually in the blood vessel.
Yeah, it moves it from the fat cell to the blood vessel.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's fats.
That's fats.
Not
sorry.
glucose.
Yes. Sorry.
So let's talk about Should we do amino acids or fats? Because I think we're done with glucose.
That's glucose done.
You're done with glucose?
So we've now addressed the
or
the carbohydrate side.
Take our message was that the glucose that's taken into by these tissues, ultimately it can be used to make ATP, but the excess is stored mostly as glycogen, or it can be stored as fatty acids.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
That's pretty much it.
Yep.
All right. Let's talk about amino acids.
All right.
So this,
so within the cheeseburger, this is the
the
patty. Well, that was the example you gave.
Okay. No, no. I think we'll go with what you said, which is the cheeseburger. So you have a protein-rich meal. The body generally will burn or use the amino acids and will incorporate the rest into proteins. That's in the fed state. What happens? We use some amino acids for energy production, but most get stored as protein, which I said is an energy, relatively energy hungry process. After the protein is ingested, digested, and absorbed as amino acids by the gastrointestinal tract, the amino acids have two fates, right?
Fates. Okay.
Yeah, not like the school.
A type of festival.
Yes. No. F-A-T-E-S.
Okay.
And it's basically what I said. They're oxidized to yield energy, or they're incorporated into protein.
I wonder really how much in a fed state that would happen.
Utilized for energy?
Yeah, it seems counterproductive to me.
Because it's biology, I would say I'm sure it happens all the time.
Okay.
But I would say predominantly the amino acids are for protein. But we can talk about how that works, right? You've got that meal. You've got the amino acids in the portal system. It goes to the liver. The liver will remove a large amount of amino acids from the portal system, but it's predominantly gluconeogenic amino acids. So these are like alanine.
Oh, so you're saying that it can selectively choose which amino acids it wants to hold on to.
That's right.
So does that mean it also makes, because when I read this, it said it's poorly understood how the liver, mm-hmm. so the hepatocyte, makes proteins, anabolic proteins, with the amino acids.
Yeah, I don't think it really does.
So do you think that it says, hey, here are my amino acids, rather than I just have pools of these amino acids? Do we just make a protein that is highly abundant with these amino acids?
Look, possibly, but my impression and what I've always thought in this process is that the liver will pull gluconeogenic amino acids. The liver is thinking about how can I use these amino acids for energy production, not protein synthesis.
But right? I'm just thinking, like, rather than just have here's a puddle of alanine, here's a puddle of what was the other ones you said?
Alamine, glutamine,
and
valine, and glycine.
Okay, rather than just have these puddles just waiting around to be used for gluconeogenesis, can I just package this into a protein that has a lot of those abundance that can be used?
Maybe, but I think it tends to funnel them into Krebs cycle. These gluconeogenic amino acids can funnel directly into the Krebs cycle.
So you want to have all those intermediates always abundant in the Krebs cycle so the Krebs cycle can continue to cycle.
Yeah. Look, I'm sure that they are stored as proteins in the liver in some regard, but in what regard? I don't know.
The textbook said that they were not sure the process on how it does this.
We know that the liver captures probably the majority of the amino acids that are moving through, specifically the branch chain amino acids. The liver doesn't really want the branch chain amino acids, the BCAAs, which a lot of people tend to take as a supplement, which is a bit useless as a supplement, by the way, and if you're getting adequate protein intake, just so you know.
There goes our sponsorship possibilities.
BCAAs are us. Branch chain amino acids are things like leucine, isoleucine, valine, right? They're branched.
What does that mean, though?
Well, predominantly, if you have a look at the branch chain amino acids, their role is they are great at protein synthesis because of their ability to be utilized in that process and to stimulate the mTOR pathway, which is a protein synthesis-based pathway.
Okay, all right.
And they directly inhibit the enzymatic processes of proteolysis or proteolysis, right?
So they just predispose you to more anabolic type events.
Yes. And this is important because liver takes gluconeogenic amino acids. The muscle will take all amino acids, but predominantly the branched chain amino acids. They're utilized for protein synthesis. They can inhibit proteolysis. We're talking about the fed state, remember?
Yep.
So insulin's also going to be present.
Yes. Right? So we're now in muscle?
We're in muscle.
Okay, so the other...
But let me add this, because let me just finish my point, is that insulin plus these branched chain amino acids being present in abundance gives you this perfect scenario for protein building. So insulin is anabolic for protein synthesis.
Sure, sure.
And it's probably one of the reasons why...
it's utilized in bodybuilding.
Yeah.
So the other thing is, so you've said that all the amino acids you just ingested from the meat patty and maybe some of the cheese is digested into their single amino acids. A lot of it's been uptake into the hepatocyte from the portal system, but the rest remain in the blood. But because what else is in the blood is insulin, that the insulin effect on muscle, skeletal muscle, is to soak up the rest of the amino acids. And they will use them hopefully to build muscle proteins.
Exactly right. So that combination of hyperinsulinemia
doesn't do that at all.
No. Well, no, because it's not a muscle tissue.
Yeah.
But yeah, that combination of hyperinsulinemia, so emia presence in the blood, doing a chubby emu reference there, that's okay, and hyperaminoacidemia as well, perfect combination to inhibit. So insulin inhibits proteolysis. That's another important thing. Insulin inhibits protein breakdown, but also stimulates protein synthesis. That's amino acids in the fed state. There's not much else to be said about amino acids in the fed state. You agree?
Yeah, okay. Right.
So now we can talk about fats. So fatty acids and triglycerides. We ingest these triglycerides or triglycerides or TAGs in a fatty meal.
So that would be the cheese?
Yeah, you could say the cheese. You could say, well, it's probably all throughout.
The oil that came out of the meat?
Yeah, making me sick now. Let's not talk about it. But generally speaking, the body will burn the fatty acids and store the rest as triglycerides. So that's what's...
Can you just talk about how they're absorbed, though? These are a bit different, the absorption of fats opposed to the other two.
Sure. So following a fatty meal, the duodenum will hydrolyze the triglycerides. So hydrolyze is like using water as scissors, basically, right? And splits the TAGs, triglycerides, into fatty acids and glycerol.
Okay.
They then get absorbed...
Glycerol completely or monoglyceride?
Good point. Yeah, it's okay. For simplicity's sake, let's just say fatty acids and glycerol.
Okay.
Right? When you're right, it doesn't like split them all up into their individual
building blocks.
But let's just say for simplicity's sake, fatty acids and glycerol. They then get absorbed at the intestines by the enterocytes.
Yep.
Right? And then inside the enterocyte themselves, they get what we call re-esterified. Basically, you chuck an alcohol side chain on and the alcohol's like the glue and it clicks them back together to repackage triglycerides at the enterocyte.
So in the cell?
In the actual, the cell that lines, you can think about it as like the barrier between the inside of the intestines, separating it from the bloodstream, the portal system on the outside, or at least the lymphatics and the portal system on the outside.
Yep.
So now we've repackaged triglycerides in the enterocytes. They're then secreted into both the lymphatics and, well, mainly the lymphatics and ultimately the systemic circulation.
Yeah. Mainly the lymphatics, I think.
As a
lacteals, right?
Yes. As a package called chylomicrons.
And so what does that mean? Just a protein with the that kind of putting a group together?
Yeah, it's a protein that contains fatty acids, glycerol, and some cholesterol.
The other thing I forgot to say, and this is going to annoy you, but going to the effect of insulin on the hepatocyte, it's also upregulating the production of these lipoproteins, which helps in the aiding of shuffling them into VLDLs and then going into the blood.
Yeah.
So the protein is the carrier for the fat.
Yes.
For both the chylomicron, but also the VLDL.
Why would that bother me?
Oh, because we kind of went back.
Oh,
whenever I do that, you're yelling.
That's just after we stop recording, yell and beat you. All right, so insulin released in response to...
Sugar.
The carb component of the meal, right, actually has three major effects on the lipid metabolism. So the first is that insulin induces an enzyme you spoke about earlier, Lipoprotein lipase.
So this is at the fat cell.
LPL, yes. So once the chylomicron, for example, has made it to the blood vessel of the fat cell.
But also the VLDL as well, both of them.
Yes, but I haven't spoken about what VLDL is yet.
We did that when we did the hepatocyte. When we spoke about one fate of glucose.
Yeah, okay. We'll get back there as well. Once the chylomicron has made it to the adipocyte or the fat tissue and it's still in the blood vessel, the endothelial cells that line the blood vessel will have LPL, lipoprotein lipase, and that will basically, again, hydrolyze like it did in the duodenum.
Yeah.
Right? It'll...
So it kind of reverses it.
Yeah, it breaks the triglycerides back up into fatty acids and glycerol, which then can enter the adipocytes, again, get re-esterified back into triglycerides, and that's where
and
it's
stored. In a, like a lipid droplet. It just gets getting bigger and bigger.
But yeah, it just keeps filling and filling and the cell gets bigger and bigger.
Interesting point here, just to remember, is when we hear this, we probably think this is subcutaneous fat, which it would be.
Yeah.
But probably it's also, well, I shouldn't say probably, it would. Mm. You're also, this process has also been occurring in visceral fat. So this could be intraperitoneal as well as extraperitoneal. And so this can be the more nasty types of fat stores, which can cause more serious metabolic issues.
Yeah.
You know, when we hear the term visceral fat. So this process, again, if you're doing this at high abundance, this can be pushing you down into more serious complications.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, I don't want to scare people, but I'm just noting here that the where this fat is being deposited can have pathological effects downstream if it happens in high amounts over long periods of time.
Yeah. And again, that's not to say that we shouldn't have dietary fat.
Correct.
Again, it's about the abundance. So insulin will promote the storage of in both muscle and adipose, right? Both the exogenous triglycerides. So these are the ones that are transported from the chylomicrons from dietary fat, right? But also the triglycerides produced endogenously or the endogenous triglycerides that are made by the liver and carried by the VLDLs. So, yes, the VLDLs are basically when the liver makes the fatty acids, connects it with the glycerol, forms the tags, throws it back into the bloodstream as very low-density lipoproteins and moves to the bloodstream. But both VLDLs and chylomicrons can be affected by the lipoprotein lipase and the insulin to be taken in, broken down, stored back, and stored as fat in the adipose tissue. So I said that the insulin, that's the first thing that insulin does. The second thing that insulin does is it stimulates glucose uptake into the adipocytes through that GLUT4 or GLUT4 transporter. Like I said earlier, turns glucose into glycerol-3-phosphate. That's needed as the backbone in order for the fatty acids and the in order for the fatty acids to re-esterify into triglycerides. So in a way, you sort of need glucose in adipose tissue to store fat.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And we spoke about why that happens because of this lack of citrate lyase in adipose tissue. So that way the glucose can be used as a glycerol substitute. And then the third thing that insulin does is it suppresses lipolysis. And so it does this by suppressing the enzymes that break down the triglycerides, the lipases.
Yeah.
So it breaks that. So insulin stimulates, inhibits lipases in the cell.
Internally.
But stimulates the external ones like the lipoprotein lipase.
But it does come from its cell to be exported out. So,
oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So I wonder how that
which is, determines the difference. It's very interesting that it can transport it out of the fat cell across into the blood cell.
Yeah.
The endothelium to then do the chopping in the blood cell.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the way I think about the liver in this whole thing is that the liver is the hub that connects the important tissues like skeletal muscle and adipose tissue together. At least, you know, it's the metabolic hub. Metabolically, it links them all together. So you go from digestive tract to either blood portal system or lymphatics to liver to then the other tissues. And in a fed state, we're mainly trying to store stuff for later.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Anything you want to, I think we sort of.
It's amazing. It's complicated, but it kind of makes sense. The only thing I'd say is we've just spoken about this metabolic state in our own cells. But the other thing to complicate the matter significantly is the effect that all this food that we've just said would have on the microbiome.
Right.
And how that then behaves, which then impacts this metabolism.
Yeah, we've spoken about, not only have we not spoken about the gut flora, which plays a huge role, we've only spoken about three tissues of the body.
Yeah.
The liver, the muscle, and the adipose.
In isolation. So I have no idea.
In a single fed state.
I have no idea what influence these 100 trillion bacterial cells, predominantly, let's say, cells, would be having in on these tissues that we've spoke about through immune, nervous system, but also their own metabolic products and how this impacts our metabolism.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Which complicates the matter significantly.
Well, it's beyond our expertise as well, to be honest. This is, we teach this at university. By no means are we biochemists. However, I think this is a really nice introduction to fed state metabolism and the hormone, predominantly insulin, that's involved in this process. Is there anything you'd like to add? Otherwise, I'm going to let everybody know how they can contact us.
No, I think I don't want to really add in any more at this point.
All right. You can contact us. Send us an email at go to our website, drmattdrmike.com.au. You can send us an email via there, or you can send an email, gubiosciences@gmail.com. Ask us a question. We do an episode every month where we do listener mail. We answer your questions. We read feedback, mainly the good stuff. But if you've got a legitimate negative feedback, send it to Matt. No problem.
I got one. Obviously, we'll read to it. But it wasn't really criticism. It was actually a nice email. We were told that our geography knowledge of Canada is terrible.
Agreed. There's no way I'm denying that. In all honesty, any complaint made about me is likely true, and I'm happy to concede and say my bad. So you can also contact us on social media. It's me at Dr. Mike Todorovic, at DrMiketodorovic. I also would like to say that we have a membership that you can join on our podcast. If you're accessing us through the typical platforms such as iTunes and Spotify, you should be able to see a little in the description of the podcast, a little link that you can click to subscribe. I think it's $5 a month. It gives you ad-free access. You get early access to all episodes. And generally speaking, that's around about 2 weeks in advance. You get the A to Zs.
And special
and
episodes.
We will, as of very soon, we will be releasing one episode per month just for the subscriber. That one subscriber that we have. No, for our subscribers. And that episode will be focusing on an important medicine, science, biology.
Maybe a contemporary issue.
Yes. Something that's happening at the moment in the news or has been published or something very cool. For example, one of the ones that we're going to be talking about is the way that the gut can influence Parkinson's disease potentially. And that's going to be only available to our subscribers in a subscriber-only feed. So please consider subscribing. The money helps, because without that, we can't justify the time away from family and our legitimate jobs. Do you agree? I didn't hang much crap on you today, did I?
Well, you did at the start with the brain scans.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was low-hanging fruit, wasn't it?
That's what you said about my pituitary gland.
that's right. Matthew, thank you. And I'll see you soon.
Thank you, everyone.
Dear listener, we'll
have a great week.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.